All right. It's a great pleasure to have our second speaker, Michael Walter, from University of Amsterdam and QSoft. And today he has promised fun with the replicas and holographic tensor networks. So thanks a lot, Michael. The screen is yours.
Hey, thanks a lot, Suki. Thanks a lot to all the organizers for inviting me. And also just for putting together this beautiful workshop. Yeah, it's a strange time right now, and it's great that these things can continue in new and interesting ways. And so yeah, also thanks to all of you sticking around for the talk. So indeed, I want to talk about holographic tensor networks. I'll explain what this means. You've already seen one, I think, yesterday in Jens's talk, and particularly a certain flavor of them called random tensor networks that admit a very simple way, a versatile way of calculating called the replica trick. And so I want to explain to you, basically, I will give you both an introduction to this model, which now is a few years old. And indeed, I think I spoke about it already at the first edition of this workshop. But for those of you who know, I also want to teach you some new tricks and some new insights that connect to recent developments. So that's the plan for the coming 40, 50 minutes or so. And so I guess to get started, of course, we all love tensor networks. That's why we're here, right? They're this versatile way of constructing interesting many-body states by gluing together webs or networks of tensors, small tensors. And in some sense, one, they're useful for a variety of reasons. So one reason, of course, they're a successful numerical tool, so particularly in one dimensions on classical computers. They've also been proposed as a tool for a quantum computer. So I think we'll have a student talk this afternoon. At least the title suggests that they'll discuss how to implement a certain wavelet mirror or investigate at least how well it fares on quantum devices. So that's very exciting, I think. Secondly, they are an analytical or theoretical tool that provides new insight by offering dual descriptions. And the idea is that sort of tensor networks allow you to focus on these virtual bonds, on these virtual degrees of freedom. We can insert operators there. We can reason about symmetries, topological order, classified topological order, and so on in this fashion. There's also a third tool, which of course closely connected to the second one, which is that we can use them as sort of a more conceptual tool to build toy models of complex phenomena. And so that's the direction in which my talk is going. So I want to discuss to you a particular sort of class of toy models that model a particular complex phenomenon, namely the holographic correspondence that some of you may know from high energy theory. And I guess it's part of the title of this workshop, of course, as well. So this indeed is my motivation. So and I'll be very high level. So this will be a quantum information talk. I'll discuss quantum information tools, but the motivation comes from a proposal from high energy theory, okay, called holography or its instantiation in the ADCFT correspondence. So roughly speaking, holography proposes that there's a way of constructing gravity, quantum gravity, in an emergent ray from a complex quantum mechanical system, a complicated quantum mechanical system that does not a priori carry any gravitational degrees of freedom. And so this goes back to this idea of the holographic principle due to Susskind and Toft. The idea being that black holes have an entropy. This entropy does not grow extensively, but rather with the system's boundary size. There was this idea that one could organize degrees of freedom in gravitational systems by the boundary, and then somehow this was elevated to this holographic principle, which was then proposed to be implemented by Maldacena and the ADCFT correspondence. So roughly speaking, what this says is that there's a way of constructing a theory of quantum gravity in d plus one dimensions and the so-called bulk. This bulk is typically in a space-time that's at least asymptotically anti-de Sitter, so a certain special kind of space-time that's not important for this talk. And the way to construct it is by instead discussing a theory that lives on the boundary of the space-time. So the space-time is this can, this filled can, and the boundary is sort of the hollow can. And on this boundary, there's just a d-dimensional quantum mechanical system, more precisely a conformal field theory, but also this will not be important for what I'll talk about. And the proposal is that these two descriptions are equivalent or dual to each other, meaning that there exists a complicated change of variables from the boundary degrees of freedom, these d-dimensional degrees of freedom, and my example, one plus one, one time, one space, so this angular space here, angular space coordinate, to a system in one dimension higher, where suddenly after this change of coordinates, these degrees of freedom, they look like they satisfy, for example, Einstein's equations for certain aspects. So there's a metric emerging. There's a semi-classical description emerging. Okay. So this is very exciting because it's one way in which we can study aspects of a theory of quantum gravity in some controlled fashion, including interesting phenomena, generally quantum phenomena, like black holes. We can construct wormhole solutions and so on and so forth. So that's sort of the starting point or the motivation, and that's what we wish to understand better. And what has been understood in recent years is that that quantum information offers a rich toolbox for understanding this emergence, or at least new diagnostics and interesting ways of looking at this idea of holography or ADCFT. And indeed, sort of our understanding, so once we start understanding holography using the quantum information toolbox, we can start building toy models. Toy models that at first reproduce some of these phenomena, but maybe also try to offer explanations. And this is sort of the focus of my talk. So as I mentioned, I want to focus on a particular toy model. This toy model will be constructed from tensor networks, hence the title of the talk and also the connection to this workshop. Okay, so here's tensor network. And the hope, of course, is that these toy models are not just toy models, but that they also can inform, maybe make predictions for what we'll for phenomena in sort of true holography, and maybe also giving ideas for extending holography beyond settings that are presently well understood. As sort of an offspring, sort of it turned out to be quite fruitful to study these interesting systems using the quantum information toolkit. And so sort of some of the things that we'll discuss, they've also been inspiration for other applications. They've sort of asked us to think in different ways about quantum error correction. There's interesting condensed matter applications, and I'll mention some of these things later on. All right. So now sort of the stage is set to give you the outline of my talk. So what I would like to discuss is I want to discuss random tensor networks as a versatile toy model of holography. I want to explain that while any quantum mechanical system has a very simple kind of replica trick, in the case of random tensor networks, it takes a particularly useful form where we can explain many interesting features, carry out many interesting calculations by, in essence, reducing them to simple questions about classical statistical mechanical models, such as easing models and related sort of pseudo-spin statistical mechanics models. And so, I mean, part of this is old news, and so I also want to mention some new things along the way, sort of three sort of more advanced features that maybe on the first reading you might skip, at least some of them. But they're interesting because they connect to recent developments. So one is I want to briefly discuss certain non-perturbative corrections that are also predicted by these toy models. Then I want to discuss the problem of quantifying entanglement beyond sort of just looking at entropies. When you look at mixed states, this is a more subtle and interesting question. And then thirdly, I want to discuss I want to go beyond single tensor network states, but discuss how one can define mappings, really, like this mapping that I proposed existed between this bulk and the boundary, using tensor networks, and how such considerations also lead to things that are closely related to recent work on the information paradox, such as what's called the generalized entropies and so-called islands. So if you don't know things, that's no problem. Sort of the talk is meant as an invitation to this particular model. But if you do know these things, maybe you'll stick around and find this an interesting thing to discuss. Okay, and so some of the things I'll mention are from our previous paper on random tensor networks, and some are from more recent ongoing joint work with Xidang, Xiaoling Qi, Cecilia Lancien, Jeff Pennington, and Frick, who's in the audience. I'll only mention the latter work very, very briefly. Okay, so that's the plan. So let's get into it. So whenever we want to build a toy model of some phenomenon or some system, we somehow have to we have to agree on what we want to simulate and what we want to emulate using the system. And perhaps the simplest thing, or the starting point for this whole connection between holography and information theory, was a focus on entropy. It was a particular behavior of entropy. Okay. So just as a brief recap, entropy is a very basic quantity in information theory, right? It's in the case of a quantum state, suppose we have a quantum system A, some corresponding density matrix rho sub A, then we can define its Feynman entropy, or just entropy, as minus trace of rho log rho. Right, that's the Shannon entropy of it, the eigenvalues of the density operator. And this is really a ubiquitous quantity. It appears all over the place. It bounds rates, it bounds capacities. It arises in many interesting formulas. In the case of pure states, it can also be used to measure entanglement. So suppose you have a pure state between two systems A and B. In this case, it is known that the entropy of both the A and the B subsystem is the same, and it's called the entanglement entropy. of the state. And for example, we know that it exactly quantifies the optimal rate at which you can convert many copies of the state to perfect maximal entanglement, okay, the limit of vanishing error. So these kind of things are very well studied. So in some sense, it's an entanglement measure for pure states. We can also use the entropy to build more complicated diagnostics, such as the mutual information, which is this sum of the local entropies minus the total entropy, minus the global entropy for a bipartite state, which can also be mixed. This is a bound on correlations. It's zero if and only if the state is uncorrelated, if its product and otherwise positive. So this is an interesting quantity. Okay. So the connection between information theory and holography really started from the following observation. It turns out that in holography, there's a proposal, which has now been proved to some extent, to the best extent possible perhaps, that there's a remarkably simple formula for computing entropies. Okay. So remember the soup can was ADS, its boundary was a sort of a cylinder, right? A space-time cylinder. Now when I look at a single time slice, I'm cutting the cylinder, I'm looking at a single slice of the cylinder, so that's a disk, okay? So the boundary of this disk corresponds to a time slice of my boundary theory of this quantum mechanical system, and the bulk describes this ominous theory of gravity that we wish to understand. And what now we can ask the following question. Well, suppose we look at some geometric subsystem of the boundary called A. You might ask, what is the thing in the bulk description that computes the entropy? Okay. And the beautiful proposal by Ryo Takainagi is the celebrated formula that proposed that in leading order, the entropy of a boundary region should be calculated by the area of a minimal surface, in this bulk. So in this hyperbolic geometry, such a minimal surface might look like this. It sort of curves inwards, or it sort of goes inwards to bulk. It's not a straight line from here to here. And it's so what we are to compute is the area of this minimal surface, a minimal surface homologous to the boundary region that we care about, divided by four times the Newton constant. Okay, so that's the Ryo Takainagi formula. And this seems like possibly a mysterious formula, but then not really to this ground here, right? Because we know that a very similar bound holds in tensor networks. Okay. Because in a tensor network, suppose I had a tensor network like this one here. It's a bit of a strange one, right? Like everything's contracted except for these dangling edges that except for going out. So this network defines a state sort of on the boundary of this picture. And we know that in any tensor network, we can always bound the entropy, even the Schmidt or the logarithm of the Schmidt rank of any reduced state. That's just the one in region A. By the size of a minimal cut through the network that chops off sort of the A part of the boundary from the other part of the boundary from these black subsystems, okay? And more precisely, the bound says the entropy is at most n is the number of qubits for each single bond, times the number of bonds in this minimal cut, which is like a discrete minimal surface that disconnects A from its complement, okay? And so it's very natural then to propose that maybe one can therefore use tensor networks to define sort of toy models of at least this entropy behavior. Okay, and this has been indeed proposed in a beautiful paper by Dan Howlow and collaborators. Okay, and it's often called the happy paper based on the mutation of the initials of the authors. And so indeed the idea is let's define a boundary state. Okay, so a state living here in this geometric boundary. Just by a tensor network in the bulk, where everything is contracted in the bulk. And ideally, we should just place very simple tensors into the bulk. So for example, these could be random tensors. So that's what happens in our model of the our variation of this model. And we might ask, okay, what's the generic behavior of such networks as the dimensions become very large? So that's sort of a natural large n limit, if you wish. Or we could look at very sort of precisely chosen refined tensors that imitate certain aspects of random states. For example, perfect tensors, which I think is something that came up also in Jens's talk. And indeed, I think Jens described a related model, so building on the work by Harlow et al. That I mentioned, whereas I'm discussing joint work with several people, including Patrick, Sherlang, Sipa, and many others. Where we propose to instead use random tensors, okay? So the idea is we fix a geometry, we fix a network, we're picking random tensors of a large bond dimension, and then we want to study the large bond dimension behavior. So that's a very strange thing to do if you want to do numerics, right? Because you want to keep that bond dimension small, but it's a very natural thing to do if you're sort of interested in this large n scaling and you want to use this as more of a conceptual tool, okay? And what we find, and we'll talk more about this, is that for large bond dimensions, so bond dimension, you take e equals 2 to the n, where n is the number of qubits per bond. So for large n, these run in these random tensor network, we get an emergent, what you could call Ryota-Kainagi law, saying that the entropy of a boundary subsystem is now indeed calculated by n times the number of edges that we cut, the size of this minimal cut or minimal surface, okay? So the general bound, the bound that holds any tensor network is approximately saturated here, okay? And so this works mostly in any geometry, in fact, which is interesting. So it doesn't need to be hyperbolic. And by now we know many variations, such as I mentioned, including one that was also discussed yesterday. So that's the idea. Okay. And so why should this be true? So why should it be true that entropies are calculated in this fashion? I want to give you two reasons, zooming into the second one shortly after. The first interpretation is the following. So suppose we take our tensor network. So that's our tensor network, and we coarse grain it. So there's sort of, so here is this minimal cut separating A from its complement. And then let's just coarse grain all the tensors on one side of the cut. Let's call the resulting object U. And let's coarse grain all the tensors on the other side of the cut. Let's call the resulting object V. Okay. Now, random tensors are, roughly speaking, isometries in any way you look at them. It's not really true, but if you know that it's not really true, then you know how to make more precise what I said. So roughly speaking, they are these perfect, but are also called perfect tensors. Okay. And so that's so now it's sort of plausible to think that maybe if you patch together many small perfect tensors, you get a big one, or at least a big isometry. Okay. So it's plausible to assume that U is an isometry from these red degrees of freedom onto the boundary, right? So there's fewer of these red degrees, there's more of the green ones, so maybe that works. And likewise for V, okay? So so if this is true though, then we find that this quantum state is, we can basically build in a very simple way. So we start with as many Bell pairs, as many maximum entangled states, as we have bonds here going across these two regions. So that's exactly proportional to the size of this minimal surface. And then we apply one isometry on the left, one isometry on the right. And that's where we built a state. But then because isometries don't change the entanglement, we know that the entanglement of subsystem A is just the entanglement of half of these entangled pairs, which is just n times the size of the minimal cut. Okay, so this sort of proves this Ryota-Kainagi behavior under this hand wavy argumentation that I made, and it can be made more precise. For example, that has been done in the paper by Dan Harlow and friends. Okay. I want to discuss a second way based on the replica trick, where we take this perspective of having really random tensors, and that averaging our random tensors is sort of correspond to some kind of disordered model, and that indeed can indeed be mapped onto, in this case, generalizations of something like a ferromagnetic spin model. Okay, so it's ferromagnetic Ising model. The idea being that then in the large quantum dimension limit, we'll find that it corresponds to the low temperature of this model. So the physics is being dominated by basically, there will be domain walls, and to minimize the energy, we want to minimize domain walls. So this will be the kind of explanation that we're after. And so to get there, I want to discuss the replica trick, okay? And as I was saying before, please do interrupt me at any point if you wish to know more, or if I shall clarify something. All right, so what's the replica trick? So I'll give you the first poor man's version of the replica trick that holds in any quantum mechanical system. And what this is saying, that suppose you want to compute some polynomial function of your quantum state, then you can always do so if I hand you many copies, many so-called replicas of the quantum state, and you just compute an expectation value in that state. Okay. In other words, something of this form, trace O, rho to the tensor N, for some observed, as you vary over all the possible observables O, or operators O, reproduces any polynomial function of a quantum state. Okay. And so the idea is, let's try to do this, but rho is now a tensor network state, a random tensor network state, and in this case, we can easily compute averages. Okay. Let me just give you an example. Okay, so we were interested in computing entropies, but entropies are not polynomials. Okay, even they're just sum over lambda I log one over lambda I. It's not a polynomial function of anything, certainly not of the quantum state rho. But there is something closely related, namely what's called the Rennie entropies, and those admit this reformulation. Okay, so the nth Rennie entropy is defined as 1 over 1 minus n logarithm of trace of the nth power of the density matrix. And this trace of the nth power is certainly a polynomial. And so we can write it as an expectation value given n replicas, n copies of our quantum state. And in this case, the observable that we have to pick is a cyclic permutation. So that of these n replica Hilbert spaces. So the one, so the operator that takes a state, and it permutes the first tensor factor to the second to the third, and so on up to the nth, going back to all the way to the first. Okay, So for n equals two, that's just a swap operator that swaps two copies, the two copies of our replica of that space that we have. Okay. So now this, what I explained so far, it works in any quantum mechanical system. What's the deal with random tensor networks? Okay. So to see this, I want to be a bit more precise and I give you a formula for a random tensor network state. Okay. So random tensor network state, like any tensor network, I can write as follows. I can first take a tensor product of all the tensors that make up the tensor network. So each of these tensor factors is going to be so v sub x is going to be the vector, the pure state, the tensor corresponding one of these blue tensors in the network. Okay, so the right hand side will just correspond to a completely decoupled, you know, sea of tensors, forest of tensors, if you wish. And then we can glue them together by projecting onto maximally entangled states, one maximally entangled state for each edge in the network. Okay, and then if we do this for all the edges that connect two of these bulk sites, we obtain an object that still has residual degrees of freedom, namely those endpoints of the tensors that we did not correspond to bulk sites, these dangling edges. And in this way, we can build our boundary state. Okay. So take a bunch of random tensors, project them to maximum entangled states. Right. And so now we can, so this is just the first half of the slide, the same as what you saw before. So now we can use this to compute entropies. Okay. It is now clear that suppose we want to compute when we've used the replica trick to write our expectation value of interest, you know, in terms of, n replicas of our quantum state. Now, n replicas, they have n bras and n cats of our quantum state psi, which means that any random tensor appears, you know, n times as a bra, n times as a cat. And so here, and suppose now we want to compute, say, an expectation value of such a quantity in a random tensor network. Then the crucial point is we just need to know how to average n copies, n replicas of a single such random tensor. And if this tensor is chosen uniformly at random from, say, the measure induced by the Hoare measure, if you wish, then there's a very simple formula for this. Namely, it is true that the average of n copies of a uniformly random tensor is nothing but it's proportional to the projector on the symmetric subspace. That is the set of all quantum states, pure quantum states, that are permutation symmetric. And we can write this projector as a sum of all permutations, pi sub x, and the permutation group Sn. So Sn is here the permutation group, not the nth Renyi entropy. And what we're summing is just a permutation operator. So it's a bit of an abuse of notation here. So pi sub x here corresponds to the operator that applies permutation pi to all the Hilbert spaces corresponding to this degree freedom x to this bulk size x. Okay. For example, on average, two copies of a random quantum state looks like identity plus one. And similarly for higher moments. Okay. And now the idea is, well, if we calculate now this average here, you're just going to get, well, we have the sea of random tensors, and for each of them we can average independently. So for each of them, we are meant to sum over one permutation pi x. And so it's easy to see that what it should get out in the end should look something like a partition function, a partition sum of some spin model, except that we are not dealing with spins, but with permutation degrees of freedom. Okay. And there's a simple action that we'll talk about in a moment, a single energy function in the spin model. And it turns out that the observable that we care about, this observable O, will just determine the boundary conditions of the spin model. Okay. So I want to demonstrate this in action, and then we'll sort of, you know, draw consequences from this throughout the rest of the talk.
Michael, sorry, can I just ask a quick question?
Of course.
So when you say a random tensor network, so it is the same tensor everywhere, but chosen randomly.
No, so here I'm picking different tensors. It's a good question. So here I'm picking them independently at random for different sites. So each of these tensors a priori is different. There has been an analysis of such a very similar model by Matt Hastings, where he discussed what happens when you take the same tensor everywhere. It's technically more challenging because then you look at much higher moments, but he explained how to, for example, analyze entropies in the setting or ranks. Great question. Thanks. Yeah, so just to reinforce, each of the tensors we're going to pick random, that's the randomness, but the network is fixed. So it's like random tensor network, not random tensor network in the sense that the geometry is random or something like that. That's also good to say. All right, so now let's see how this works in action, okay, by a graphical calculation. So suppose we care about the second Renyi entropy, that's minus the logarithm of trace of rho a squared. So by the replica trick, trace of rho a squared is just the trace of two copies of rho, times a permutation operator that only acts on the A, namely a swap that permutes both of these A systems. That's what I explained before. Okay, so somehow we want to compute kind of what's the average of trace rho A squared, let's say. And we'll do this step by step. So first, let's start with our tensor network. So this is the cat of our tensor network. I'll indicate it graphically like so. Okay. Now, how do we put the density matrix? Well, we take one bra and one cat. Now we need two copies of this because our replica trick asks us to have two copies. So now here we have two copies of the cat, two copies of the bra. Okay. And again, these are sort of the A degrees of freedom, right? There's two cats and two bra, A degrees of freedom. So now what we really care about is not rho tensor rho, but this particular expectation value, the expectation value of the slop operator acting on the A sites. Okay. So what we do is, well, we slop the A degrees of freedom here, and we take the trace, which means connecting the legs. Okay. So now this picture here corresponds to trace of rho A squared. So now we have to do one more thing, right? Now we want to average this quantity. So you want to take the average, and as we explained before, because of the independence, we can average any pair of random tensors independently from each other. So what we really want to understand is what is the average of two copies of this random tensor or this random tensor or that random tensor. And well, what is this average? Well, we explain that the average of a random tensor, if we take two copies, is just a sum of an identity and a swap operator, okay? And I can write this in this kind of complicated way, which is to say that, well, I have to pick once whether I want, so this black dot is sort of a control, it's a degree of freedom that's either identity or swap. If I pick identity, then I'll do an identity on all of three of these lines, because all these like subhilbert spaces of X, they're treated the same way. If I pick a swap, I'm going to swap all of them, okay? In other words, the swap operator on, you know, these replicas, tensor these replicas, tensor these replicas, is the same as swapping those pair and that pair at the same time, okay? So now we just insert this formula everywhere and we get the following beautiful slash confusing picture. Okay, so what we have to do is we have three degrees of freedom, these black dots. And each of these degrees of freedom, we have to pick whether we do identity or a swap. And once we decide, we have to do the same on all of these green gates. Okay, so for example, if I pick this one swap, I'm gonna swap here, here, and here. And now, okay, what does then the loop mean? Well, we are taking this trace, and it's clear that suppose if this is an identity and that's an identity, then we get a factor of dimension squared. Whereas if one is a swap and the other is not, we only get a dimension D because that's only going to be a single loop. In other words, the dominant contributions come from the situation where most of these choices are aligned, okay? And that sounds like an easing model, it sounds like a ferromagnetic easing model. Indeed, we can sort of graphically visualize this as follows. At each of these controls, at each of these vertices, we're picking either spin down or spin up, okay? Let's say spin up corresponds to not swapping, spin down corresponds to swapping. Then we have boundary conditions, right? This is because we're always swapping on A, but we're never swapping on these other boundary sites. So this is always spin down, this is always spin up. And then we have an energy cost, if you wish, or that is basically proportional to these spins not being aligned, okay? In other words, we've derived an easing model with funny boundary conditions. So then we can summarize this here, okay? So this is now the summary. So it turns out that doing this nth Remy calculation, sorry, this should be a factor of two and there's a minus missing. I'm not sure what happened in this last minute change of the slide. Sorry, it's Remy two entropies minus log of trace of A squared, not what I wrote, minus log trace of rho squared. Now, what I discussed to you, I explained to you that the average of the Remy two entropy, the average of rho A squared and also by concentration, actually trace of rho A squared itself, is given by a partition function simply of a ferromagnetic easing model. And it turns out that what plays the role of the inverse temperature here is the logarithm of the bond dimension. That is the number of qubits for each bond, okay? So what this means is that at a large one dimension limit, this system is like in the very low temperature limit. And as we discussed before, things like the free energy should be dominated by the ground state energy and the ground state configurations, okay? There's an energy gap that's like one over D. Log D. And indeed, okay, what's the point? Well, the point is that if I would have written down the correct formula here, which is the one that's written here, you see that the Remy 2 entropy is basically the free energy corresponding to this model. So this thing is exactly equal to the ground state energy plus terms that are suppressed. Suppressed as the bond dimension becomes large, that is the temperature goes to zero. Okay. And now what is the energy cost of such a model? Well, it's clear. We have these boundary conditions that are so spin up on one side, spin down on the A region, spin up on the other side. And in the middle, we are free. But what will happen, of course, is that we are going to pick a domain wall that has minimal length because the only price that we are paying here is for this domain wall. Okay, so the cost, the energy cost in the ground state is precisely proportional, or in my normalization equal, to the size of the domain wall, and then the inverse temperature enters here, and it gives us this log d, okay? So what you find is that the second Grignard entropy is for large bond dimensions, just scaling as the logarithm of the bond dimension times the size of this minimal surface. And so that's exactly the discrete counterpart of this Takanagi formula, emerging very naturally from this, you know, replica trick and statistical mechanical mapping, Statnik model mapping, okay? And now one can do a very similar analysis for higher Grignard entropies. So this slide is a bit of a mouthful. The top part is what we just saw, okay? So this is the spin model, the Ising model here at inverse temperature log dimension. And now the formula is fixed. This is the general formula for the nth Grignard entropy. This is what we just discussed, that the second Grignard entropy for large bond dimension has this, it looks like the Takanagi formula. And it's interesting to ask, what is the general situation, okay? And we kind of already know, because we already discussed that the right replica trick to do for the nth Grignard entropy, or rather for trace rho to the n, is that we want to write this as taking n replicas and then computing the expectation value of a cyclic permutation on the A boundary. So completely analogously, if you go through the derivation, either graphically or by pen and paper, or analytically, you'll find a spin model where now the degrees of freedom of the spin model are permutations, right? They're permutations of n elements, because that's the what happens when you average random tensors. You get a sum of all permutations, one for each site in the model. And I have to tell you, well, what are the boundary conditions and what is the energy cost for a bond in this model? The boundary conditions are clear because, as I said, we are picking this the expectation value of the cyclic permutation operator, okay, on the A boundary. So the boundary conditions will just be the cyclic permutation. So it's an N cycle to be precise here. On the rest, we just pick identities. And now I have to tell you what's the energy cost in this model, and that's going to be the same for the rest of the talk. In these permutation spin models, or these permutation degree of freedom models, the energy cost for an edge, for a bond, is exactly the minimal number of swaps that you need to get from one permutation to the other, or the minimal number of transpositions that you need to convert one permutation to the other. That's called the Cayley distance. One can compute it in terms of cycles, cycle decomposition of the difference of the two permutations and so on. For n equals two, any permutation identity on a swap, and this just reduces to the Ising interaction. Because this thing is a metric, the general model will still be ferromagnetic in general, even though it looks a bit more complicated. But indeed, somehow one can do the same analysis and one finds that, well, again, the ground state configuration will be the one where we fill this entire domain left of the minimal surface by the same cyclic permutation. So there's zero energy cost in this domain. On the other side, we fill the domain with identity permutations. So the only energy cost, again, comes from this domain wall. And now it turns out that the distance between a cycle and an identity, that's just the number of swaps you need to build a cycle, that's n minus one. So we get a ground state energy of n minus one times the size of the minimal surface. And this n minus one is exactly canceled in the definition of the Grignard entropy, from which we find that all the Grignard entropies in this model, not just the second Grignard entropy, satisfy this Takanagi formula. So we find that actually all the Grignard entropies are roughly speaking the same, at least assuming that this is the only minimal surface. And we find a flat entanglement spectrum in this model. Okay, so the entropies are all the same and they all satisfy this Takanagi formula. All right.
Michael, sorry, quick question.
Yeah.
For this result, are there any assumptions on the size of the tensor network and the size of the cut?
No, but it's in the large bond dimension limit. So in some sense, that smooths out things nicely. So it's somehow the entropy behavior here is simpler than, say, in the happy model, which is more tricky because there's low bond dimensions, right? It's much more subtle in a way. So here, that's kind of all smeared out in the large bond dimension limit. The catch being that, you know, the question, how large does the bond dimension really have to be? That depends on the geometry of the graph.
But I can consider a very small tensor network.
You could consider a very small, did you say graph? Or did?
Graph, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You could consider a small tensor network, but with very high dimensional tensors. That's correct. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So quick question. So would you expect some sort of phase transition as you bring D down to a non-holographic regime?
Yeah, that's right. And this has been studied in follow-up work. I forget the name of the authors. So I apologize. Well, either case, if they are in the audience or not. I'll paste it in the Slack later. So this has been studied and beautiful follow-up work. And indeed, there's a phase transition going on there. And I'm studying it deep in sort of the ferromagnetic phase, where this area law, this weird Takenagi area law dominates. Great question.
And is there any notion of a replica symmetry breaking here?
Very good. Yeah, I'll talk about this in a moment. Yeah, great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, so indeed. The story I discussed so far is the one if this minimal surface is unique. And one could ask what happens more generally. And there's interesting phenomena happening there. So I want to discuss this now briefly. Okay. So one interesting thing that one can look at is the following. Suppose you have this geometry, it's again this hyperbolic disk, cartoon hyperbolic, and now I'm not even drawing the tensors anymore because it's all going to be graphically, okay? So suppose I focus on the region that is both A and B, okay? And you could ask, what is the minimal sort of the ground state energy of an easing model, for example, on you know, with the boundary conditions where I've sort of spin down boundary conditions at both A and B and spin up on the complement, okay? Then in this situation, well, the right thing to do is we'll basically have two domains, one domain here, one domain there. And then here you will fill them with the swaps or the spin down, I think, and the rest is spin up. Okay. But as you make A and B larger, there's also the following situation. When A and B become really large, right? They move closer together. And actually the dominant configuration is one where you have such a connected domain. Okay, because now, so there's two possible options. There's this area plus this area where you pay some energy, are these gray ones, right? But the gray ones are larger. So there's a sort of a phase transition going on, and it can, for example, be quantified by looking at the mutual information between A and B. Because the mutual information is entropy of A plus entropy of B plus entropy of AB. Here, the entropy of AB is just a sum, so mutual information is zero, or close to zero. Whereas here, it's very large, because some of the mutual information of A is this area, mutual information of B is this area, but we are only subtracting the smaller things. And so it's very interesting to ask what happens, for example, here, to phase transition. And you know, so say phase transition meaning when this area plus this area is the same as this area plus that area. Okay, and okay, we know two configurations already that could play a role. We can sort of have you know two domains, these red domains, or we can have like a single connected domain like over here. But it turns out there's a much higher degeneracy here, right? And also one that doesn't really respect the symmetry of the boundary condition. Namely, we can pick any permutation tau here in the middle, so we can create the new domain. And this new domain can carry any permutation tau that sort of sits in the middle between the identity and the cycle, okay? And for high Renyi entropies, for a large N, there exist lots of these permutations. In mathematics, they're known as non-crossing permutations. And what it means physically is that in some sense, this domain wall can split at no cost, because if you sort of walk along a line here, then you'll just pay the cost from identity swaps, cost from swap to X, but that's just the same as the original cost from identity to X. So these domain waves, they can break or they can like split, and then they can again minimize the area independently. So that's why this is a valid configuration. Okay. And now from our PowerPoint broke, but the point is that this high degeneracy itself, I mean, it's really scaling exponentially with N, and it leads to a non-trivial interesting entanglement spectrum, one that is known from random matrix theory. It's called the Marchenko-Pastor law. And indeed, this is a kind of effect that you see in the large bond dimension limit. So it's a non-perturbative correction, if you wish. Due to you know having these many more configurations here, right? And actually, in some sense, the boundary conditions they have the cyclic symmetry, but that's sort of broken here. Okay. Very good. Okay. super. So that's one sort of more advanced effect, and it's sort of interesting because it ties in with some recent research, but it's also a bit more advanced. But it's interesting the punchline is at this phase transition, there's an interesting phase transition that's sort of geometrically where the between mutual information zero and mutual information large. So large meaning proportional to the log bond dimension, proportional to the number of qubits per bond. And there's some interesting phenomena happening here. Okay, so maybe it's time for a little recap. So I presented this random network model to you, a sort of intuitively motivated toy model that was meant and in fact did reproduce the Takenagi formula. It also produced a bunch more things that we'll discuss. And we saw that this replica trick is particularly pleasant to use in random tensor networks. Okay. Now, is this relevant for anything? How does this connect to holography, which is what we meant to simulate and imitate in the first place? Okay. So this Takenagi formula is proved similarly, again, using a replica trick, But if one does this, in the actual setup of holography, then what one does is one has some one takes the same topology that I discussed, roughly speaking. But then there's actually some physics and some action, and then one looks at saddle points of an action, and there's Einstein's equations kicking in, and those are deforming this replicated geometry. So it's not the case that somehow these minimal surfaces, they will just be n, so these higher kind of analogs of this minimal surface that you get there, say for n replicas, for example, area just n times the replica of these brains. What this means in practice is that the entanglement spectrum is not flat, and that's very well known for conformal field theories, for example, one plus one dimension, the Reni entropies are not all the same, and that seems like a problem. Okay, and so it seems like, okay, maybe that's as far as the toy model goes. However, all hope is not lost, because remarkably, actually the tensor network calculation does have an analog in holography. Namely, some of you will know what's called fixed area states. These are states defined using gravitational path integral, where you fix the area of a minimal surface. It turns out in that case, the entropic behavior actually is made flat. So the entanglement spectrum becomes flat, and actually there's a tight match between the Rent tensor network calculations and calculation fixed area states, not just for entropies, but also more generally. And this will also be a theme that we'll meet again in the last, 10 or so minutes of the talk. So this was discovered by these people. And what's more is that, in some circumstances, one can take a general holographic state with a non-trivial spectrum, expand it in the basis of fixed area states, and then use some approximations to lift results. Okay, so the point being that we have this very toy model, but it connects quite tightly to something more real, and these fixed area states, and those are again one can somehow try to understand general phenomena in general non-fixed area states holography, sort of by expanding in the spaces. Okay. So that's one thing I want to say. Another thing I want to say is that there has been also, other interesting developments since, not studying tensor networks made of completely random tensors, but say of random unitaries. So people have also studied random quantum circuit models, or can also provide references on Slack. And they similarly can be studied using the replica trick. There's a STATMAG model arising. It's a bit more complicated because the moments of a random unitary are more complicated as a Hall random tensor. There's an interesting phenomenology, and it's really quite an interesting thing to do, right? One can study shallow circuits that's related to these quantum supremacy proposals. One can add measurements, look if there's phase transitions, and there's many beautiful works that have been done at this interface that I'm happy to link to on Slack. Okay, so just as to provide some perspective, and also the message I said before that we can also learn, it's interesting to study these models, maybe also beyond the motivation holography. All right. So now I want to discuss two variations. Let's see if we have time for them. One is, so far we computed entropy. There's more to entropy than life. For example, there's entanglement. Okay. And entanglement and entropy are not the same for mixed states. And just to recap, a mixed state, rho AB, is called entangled, not if it's not a product state, but if it's not a mix of product states. Okay. So a mix of product states, a quantum information theorist would not consider entangled. You can explain it by a mixture of something that has not even correlations. So something of this form is called an entangled state. And it's clear that this is a much harder thing to check, right, than if you just had a single tensor product. In particular, the entropy is not a good measure. It can distinguish classical from quantum classical correlations from quantum entanglement generically. So we don't do this. And in fact, this is a hard problem in the NP-hard sense. It's NP-hard to check whether a quantum state is not entangled or entangled. And but this means that in practice, there's a zoo of entanglement measures. Most of them are hard to calculate. And what I want to do is I want to focus on one that's not so hard to calculate, but it's sort of a bit blind. It doesn't see all entanglement, okay? And the way to define this is by using what's called the partial transpose, and we are going to look at what's called the negativity or the logarithmic negativity of a quantum state. So the idea is, suppose you have a bipartite density operator, rho AB. Let's define the partial transpose, where this gamma looks like half of a transpose, so we're only transposing on the right, as just the operator that you get by transposing the B indices. So the B bra becomes a ket, the B ket becomes a bra, but the A indices remain the same. Now, if our state was a product state to begin with, right, so cut in half here, then this would just transpose one of the tensor factors that, would still lead to a perfectly good density operator. Particularly, the resulting object would be positive semidefinite. So, and then it's easy to see that the same is true for mixtures just by convexity. And so it is a fact that if rho AB is not entangled in this correct sense, mixture of product states, then this partial transpose density operator always has non-negative eigenvalues. In other words, negative eigenvalues can serve as a diagnostic for entanglement, okay? And so this we can turn into a quantitative measure. So that's what I said is called the Paris criterion. And this can be turned into a quantitative measure. We can define what's called the logarithmic negativity, which is the logarithm of the sum of the absolute values of the eigenvalues lambda, not the eigenvalues not of rho AB, but of its partial transpose. Okay, so lambda are the eigenvalues of the partial transpose. And it is known, it's easy to see that the trace of the partial transpose is always equal to one if rho is normalized. So the absolute values are at least one, and they're exactly one if all the lambdas are positive. Okay, if some of the lambdas are negative, then this sum of absolute values will be strictly larger than one, and therefore this logarithmic negativity will be larger than zero. In other words, this entanglement measure, the logarithmic negativity, is positive. If it is positive, then the state is entangled. But the converse is not necessary true. There are some entangled states that we cannot detect in this fashion, but we hope that the states that we want to consider are sufficiently harmless such that this is a good diagnostic. So we want to calculate this logarithmic negativity. It's again a logarithm of something, but this thing sadly is not a polynomial. Okay, so it's a sum of absolute values. So what do we do? Well, I'll give you the hand wavy derivation. There's sort of a rigorous random matrix way of doing it as well. And the hand wavy is the one is the following. Well, let's just define Rennie quantities like before. Let's compute an even moment, so the sum over all these eigenvalues to the power 2k, because that's an even power and these eigenvalues are real. I can just drop the absolute value, and that's just the same as the trace of the partial transpose density operator to the 2k. And now we have a power to the 2k, and we can hope for a replica trick. And indeed, there is a replica trick, except that now because I have this partial transpose, this transpose in B, what is going to happen is that instead of having two cyclic permutations, one on A and one on B, I have a cyclic permutation A and its inverse on the other side, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to calculate this for all K, for all integer K, and then analytically continue to K equals 1/2, or alternatively do a more precise random matrix argument, okay? Because for K equals 1/2, this thing, right, it looks, it's the, so it's the sum of absolute values, which is what we want for this negativity. Now, this we can do, again, by a StatMac model, this permutation degrees of freedom. We have now different boundary conditions than before. So say this is A, then here we have these X, the cyclic permutation boundary conditions. On the other side, there's the inverse of X. Here we have identity, and one can again carry out an analysis. That's recent, very recent work with Shidong from UCSB, and Xiaoling Qi from Stanford, where we discuss sort of how this works in random tensor network model as well as in holography. What we find is that there will be a fourth domain emerging in the middle, and this fourth domain will again carry permutations that I'll call tau, which are sort of on a geodesic between all of these boundary conditions. So as you go from X to X inverse, as you go from X to identity, as you go from identity to X inverse, this tau basically never creates any additional cost. And that's the reason why we can just freely form this tau domain and then minimize these other surfaces, and they become minimal surfaces, okay? And it's interesting that these taus exist, and again, they are breaking replica symmetry with regards to the question that was asked before. So here's one, it's just a product of pairwise swaps. In general, there's some interesting thing, again, related to the non-crossing partitions and Catalan numbers and whatnot. What's the upshot? The upshot is that we can calculate this negativity in the large N limit. We find that it's roughly 1/2 the mean transformation, but not exactly. There's no order one correction, okay? And in fact, we can compute the whole spectrum of this partial transpose in this fashion. You can think of this correction saying that the entanglement is not maximal, because for a maximal entangled state, this will be inequality. Okay, that's one way of interpreting it. And just to be to shortly summarize, so a similar replica trick can be done in holography. For fixed area state, it works. We find agreement. And as mentioned, there's some replica symmetry breaking going on here, which is interesting because that doesn't pop up so often. And we don't know so many examples. Here there's really one where trace seems to play a crucial role. Okay. Now one could ask many other questions. One could ask, how can we dissect a holographic state, whether, a toy model state or a real one, into building blocks? There's some work on this, but in general, I think that's a wide open, very interesting question. It's very interesting to look at more general observables of this form and ask what they mean. So that's something we're thinking about at the moment, right? So in particular, the ones where you just glue different permutations on the boundaries. These are always invariants, of the entanglement, if you wish, in a certain sense I could make precise. It's interesting to ask what they mean, what they look like, what they correspond to. So maybe that's as much as I want to say here. So that's the entanglement discussion. So now I think I should probably wrap up. So maybe I will not go into this, except for saying, maybe giving you the intro slide, and then you may, you're very welcome to ask me questions. I think also there's a break afterwards, so we can just chat a bit more. The last thing I wanted to discuss is, in some sense, a continuation of something. It's something that we've known for a while, but now it's of acquired new meaning. And the idea is that so far I just described single states to you. Now, instead of describing single states, really holography or this ADCFT corresponds is a correspondence. It maps states in the bulk to states in the boundary. It's just not, it's not just producing one single, you know, fancy state with an interesting entanglement and entropy structure. So how can we do this now a toy model? Well, it's clear we can do the same, use our trusty tensor networks. Simply what we do is that on each tensor that we have in the bulk, we add an additional leg. And I think you also saw this in Jens's talk yesterday, I'm sure. You have these red legs, which we can think of input legs. So we can feed in a state into these red legs, and then out comes a state on the boundary. So the tensor network here implements a mapping. So it's not a unitary mapping like in Ignacio's talk, but it's going to be an isometric mapping here under some conditions. Okay. So you can think of this as a way of encoding these bulk degrees of freedom into the boundary. Okay. And now it's interesting to ask, if I put in a certain state, what happens with the boundary? What do the entropies look like? And so on. And so one can do this analysis, and it's interesting, and we won't do it today. But roughly speaking, the answer is the following. Suppose you put in a state into these bulk degrees of freedom. Let's say a state. So here's my cartoon. I put in some state into the bulk. I get out a state on the boundary. And I could ask, what is the entropy of a boundary subsystem like before, like this entropy A? Now, in a certain sense, you might have expected this is the area of the minimal surface. And then maybe there's an additional contribution coming from the entropy of the state you put in, restricted to the subregion A that's sometimes called the entanglement wedge in the literature. Okay. It turns out that generically, that's not the right answer. But what you should rather do is you should jointly minimize a geometric term and an entropic term. You should minimize the area of the of a surface plus the entropy of the bulk state restricted to the region. And in general, this is not the same as first geometrically minimizing and then computing the entropy. So these minimal surfaces are therefore in the literature called quantum minimal surfaces. They minimize what's called the generalized entropy. One can again prove this using a replica trick. And it's interesting to say that these kind of that this formula and related aspects really has featured crucially in these very recent developments on the black hole information paradox, rewriting the page curve, giving a bulk picture of black hole evaporation, evaporation by replica trick style calculations by both Pennington and the East Coast collaboration surrounding Ahmed Almiri. I think that's a typo. And it's kind of surprising that the tensor networks reproduce these features. Okay. And here is just a simple example of what will happen, and then we'll come to the islands. We can wrap up. Suppose I take as my bulk state a very heavily entangled state between two distant bulk sites, say here and there. Okay. Now, what if you chose the surface gamma as follows? Suppose I choose my surface gamma as here. Well, what would I pay? I would pay the entropy. So this is an area term here. But then I would also pay lots of entropy because this state is very it's highly entangled, this black state that I put in. Okay, so I'll also pay the entropy of that state. I could also look at a different configuration where my quantum minimal surface is both this red curve and this one. And in that case, well, both endpoints of the max entangled state are contained in the blue region. So I don't pay any price, but I'm paying a slightly larger area price here, okay? So maybe this was a bit quick, but the point is, because of this formula, suddenly you can get regions that are disconnected to the boundary. These regions have been called islands, and they're indeed something, I think we'll also hear more of them perhaps at this conference, but they're something that has to have crucially featured in these developments. So it's kind of interesting that they even appear in this very simple toy model, and an interesting question to ask what kind of conclusions can be drawn from this. All right, so I'll wrap up. Holography is cool. We have connections between geometry entanglement. Tensor networks are cool because we can study them. We can build toy models. Random tensor networks are particularly cool because they have the simple replica trick, and things are actually connected via these fixed area states. Thanks very much, and sorry for running over time.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for this fun talk. Any questions?
Perhaps I have a short question about the islands we're talking about. First of all, a very good talk. So this aspect about having essentially islands if you have strong bulk entanglement. I mean, in some sense, if you add entanglement between distant bulk sites in a tensor network, I mean, it's not really clear whether the geometry that represents the state is really planar anymore, right? Because I mean, you could
Yes. No, exactly. So I think that's and virtue in some sense, right? Sort of this R equals EPR game in some sense, right? Like in some, it's only right, right? So what you're saying, Alex, is like, if you add maximum entanglement between two distant sites, that's just like changing the network to begin with, right? So nothing's going on really. The thing is that you can, and but I think this is exactly what we want in a way, right? This is really sort of, in some sense, a manifestation of this, you know, entanglement equals geometry postulate in this toy model. And of course, it's also true for more sort of complicated kinds of entanglement structures that there's this sort of, that you can have these islands emergent, where maybe it doesn't correspond to like a naive maximally entangled edge, but to some like richer kind of entanglement structure. But it's a great point, yeah. Good to see you.
So any last questions?
Yes, so if I may, I have a small question. So so I would like to ask actually what is not working in your picture. So what are the kind of the features that cannot be reproduced in tensor networks? And I especially think about, well, if we try to use tensor network for simulating condensed matter systems, well, one of the big problematic things are these chiral edge modes. Is there some kind of a similar problem that you have here, that there's some features that are related to something chirality that cannot be reproduced, or that's not an issue?
I think for now the things we've discussed, they are sufficiently primitive that this wouldn't pop up. But I think for a long time I would have said that the fact that the entanglement spectrum is just plain wrong, that's an issue. Now we have this great excuse that we can say, oh, it actually corresponds to fixed area states. But it would still be satisfying to have a more complete picture there. Something that I find maybe more puzzling. Maybe something I also swept a bit on the rug, which I think is something to think about harder, is this issue of how large the bond dimension should be, right? If I have a really large bond dimension that's exponentially larger than my system size, I'm not sure how interesting, you know, what I explained really is. So I think making this sharper, I think, is an interesting thing to do. What I find maybe the thing that puzzles me most is how to add dynamics to the picture, how to have, right? Because all of the formulas I showed, they're in some sense special cases of more general formulas. We're actually extremizing not computing minimum surfaces on a single time slice, but you're extremizing surfaces, sort of quote, I mentioned two things in the whole space time. And I don't know how to do this kind of at all in some sense. I mean, there's some very beautiful work by Xiao Lang and friends where they sort of made some steps towards this, but I think that's maybe, I would say, our main challenge. There's also nice work by, Tamara, I forgot her last name, and Toby Kubitz, right, where they discuss ways of constructing Hamiltonians for these toy models. I think that's also very cool. So at least there's some proposal for dynamics, but somehow gluing this together to a coherent picture, that I think is one of the key questions to me. I don't have a great effect to point to right now with regards to chirality, but maybe that's just because of the lack of detail of the model at this point. I'm not sure if maybe Alex or Jens have thoughts on this in their works. Yeah, thanks.
All right, so if there are no further questions, I would like to thank Michael again on everyone's behalf. Thanks, Michael.